What would you say if I offered to stake you in a game against the chief?
What?
I put up the money, you play the game, and we split 50-50.
I think I'll go now, if you don't mind.
What's wrong?
I enjoyed the earlier part of this evening very much.
I shall always remember the pleasure of your company. I didn't even mind this dressing up bit. But I do mind bloody unnecessary jokes about the one thing I really know well.
Listen, Evelyn, I'm serious. It's because you really know about Baccarat that I'm not joking. You said you needed £100,000?
Hmm?
It's yours.
It's fantastic. Oh, well, look here, I mean, old the chief had never agreed to play me. He's read my book. He'd recognize my name.
No, no, not anymore.
Why?
We have chosen a new name for you.
Oh?
James Bond.
To Goonpod. My name is Tyler Adams, and in the spirit of Peter Sellers in this week's film, I absolutely refuse to be in the same room as my guest. So thankfully we're connected via Zoom.
Which is probably the best way of doing it, really.
And that voice you can hear is my guest. It is Martin Holmes. Hello, Martin.
Hello, how are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad despite this film.
Despite it, yes. Yes. I feel we have to lay our, as it were, cards on the table quite early.
Well, I have yes, I have shown my hand quite early. There are
I've got my special glasses on, so I can see what your hand is.
Oh, yes, very good. Martin Holmes, famous for Vision on Sound, of course.
Well, not that famous, but yeah.
Well, famous in my house.
Yeah, well, there we go. That's all it needs to be, really, isn't it? That's it.
So for the uninitiated, what is Vision on Sound, Martin?
Vision on Sound is a weekly radio show, although it's basically a podcast, really. It's a podcast that gets broadcast on Fab Radio out of Manchester, where we talk about old and archived television, although we actually talk about anything that is prompted by the idea of talking about television. So we turn up an hour a week, Sundays at 7 o'clock, on Fab Radio International, I suppose I might as well say that. Mm-hmm. And basically me and a group of fairly regular people, though we do get sort of more people in occasionally, but it's kind of a group of regulars and then the occasional new person sort of comes into the mix. And we basically take a topic that's loosely related on our experiences of archive television and waffle on about it for an hour, which we've been doing now for nearly 4 years, and it seems to work. The people who like it, and we turn up and we try and make some sort of sense out of issues arising. Even we don't necessarily just sit there and go, well, on the fifth episode of the third series, we don't know that. We don't do that, but do that. We could do that if that's what people wanted. But it's more just enjoying television, and we have an hour to do that every week, which is nice.
It's a sort of show that would appeal to people who remember programmes like The Corridor People.
Yeah.
Or Spindo.
Yeah.
Because you're very much focused on, not necessarily obscure, but it's very much, it's of a certain period. It tends to be more sort of 60s, 70s, into the
80s. Yeah, last century, definitely.
Yeah,
we do occasionally, someone does decide they want to talk about something modern, and I sort of grip my teeth and let them.
Yeah.
But that's fine. And, you know, the thing about it is that it allows us to actually sort of take the subject and spin it. You know, it doesn't have to be about a particular programme. Sometimes we do that, but we have a nice time doing it, and I hope people enjoy listening to it.
I was on, listeners.
You were?
A couple of months ago, talking about me, which is my favourite subject.
Well, it was about your experiences of British television because you were on the other side of the world at the time. I believe you mentioned that occasionally.
Well, it was mainly about me.
Well, let's face it, aren't all our shows mainly about us? Really?
I suppose so. Is life... Anyway, that's... I don't want to get philosophical at this point. Okay. And Martin, you've been on previously. I know that it was going back a while, actually, but you're not a... It's fair to say maybe I'm doing you a disservice, but you're not a huge comedy fan, necessarily. You're more of a drama buff.
I tend to talk about drama more because I know it more. Mm. I understand it more. Comedy and me... I don't find comedy as rewatchable or as re-listenable to. I mean, mm-hmm. I have various CDs of radio shows and what have you, but I tend towards, if I've got a bored evening, I'll probably go and look for a drama to watch. I don't sit there and thought, I'll stick six episodes of Blackadder on tonight. I don't find comedy that engaging in the same way. It's not that I don't enjoy it because I have shelves with these things on. It's not that I snub them and say, no, I will have no tittering in my house, none of that. It's, I don't engage with it in quite the same way. There's a lot of crossover certainly in archive television, there's a lot of crossover with comedy actors who did serious roles. And I mean, I was talking with Steve Hatcher only the other week, and we were talking about how Alfie Bass turned up on Gideon's Way. You know, so you got someone who is well known for the army game Bootsy and Snudge, mm-hmm. but then did serious roles. And I kind of like that, which is weird because my interest in Sellers, I think, came from his movies, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't really discover him through The Goon Show. I discovered The Goon Show through Sellers.
I've just noticed as well, just thinking about it, just sitting here, because the Goonpod took a bit of a hiatus for about 2 or 3 months, and we've been back for eight. This will be the ninth show of the new run. Right. This is the first specifically Sellers topic we've covered.
There you go.
There you go. We've barely spoken about Sellers for weeks and weeks.
Snubbed him, I say.
Yes. So we are talking, but unfortunately, we're not going to be talking about one of his better films today. But that's oftentimes that's more interesting. So we're talking about Casino Royale, the 1967 version.
You hesitate to call it a film.
Yes. Well, okay. So Martin, why this film?
Why this film? Well, funnily enough, when I was 10 years old, the first James Bond film came on ITV. I don't think I was allowed to watch that because I was probably a bit young. But that's when they started showing them, and there were articles in the TV Times and all that kind of thing. And so I became, over the course of the next probably 3 or 4 years, the biggest James Bond fan in the world, as far as I understood it. I obviously wasn't, but at that time, I just genuinely thought, oh, I love these films. 25 years on, and certain women in my life who I met dissuaded me of that, and they did tell me that they weren't necessarily the greatest films as far as they were concerned, and I hardly watch them now, to be fair. But back then I bought books about it, I had a scrapbook, everything like that. I'd cut the things out of the TV Times, everything like that. And one of the things I bought in my strange collector mania that quite a lot of people who have interests in things have is I picked up Jeff Love's James Bond movie themes LP. And, I was an expert by now. I'd read about all these things and everything like that. And I knew there was Dr. No from Russia with Love, Thunderball, all this kind of thing. And there was this tune on it, which was the theme to Casino Royale. And I thought, they haven't made that one, because I was knowledgeable and 12, I knew everything about the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm thinking, well, what's this? And I thought, it's quite a nice tune. I quite like that, And then, of course, I picked up a couple of other books, and they would talk about this film that they didn't really it's not really official, it's not really talked about.
It's like the illegitimate child that no one talks about.
It's a very bizarre piece of 60s somethingness. I'm not even it exists in a kind of parallel universe to the James Bond films, and yet obviously it shares its title with the first book. And I think I read about Casino Royale, the film, before I ever saw it. So eventually I probably sat down and it came on some channel at some ridiculous hour of the morning or whatever, and I thought, oh, I shall watch this. I shall set my video. And I would just sat there, and you would be kind of floored by it. Because one, it seems to go on forever. Now, that could just be because they were putting a lot of commercial breaks in it. It's a very long film. And I think it feels very long because sometimes it feels very laboured as a film. Now, I know a lot of people love this film. I get that. I mean, I know when you announced that we were going to talk about it, you know, some people said, oh, great, I'm really looking forward to that. I really like that film. And some people absolutely detest it. It's Marmite. You know, it's the Marmite movie. It's so 1960s, it almost hurts. It's almost like if you shook up all of the 1960s, put it in a bottle, you know, shook it up and let it explode, you'd probably get the Casino Royale movie somehow. Yeah.
Before we start talking about, you know, the nuts and bolts of the film, the nuts particularly.
The nuts, yeah. Fewer bolts, yes.
Yes. Let's just kick off with a short history of how this huge, bloated confection of a film came about, shall we?
Indeed.
Firstly, I want to share a maxim that I carry around with me. It's this: an average to lousy film is always improved if Cribbins or Bluthal turns up. You think about that, it's true, isn't it? Anyway, let's park that for now, but we will return to it. So now let's look at the origins of this film. Ian Fleming published the first James Bond novel, Casino Royale, in 1953. The following year, a live one-hour television adaptation aired in the US, starring Barry Nelson as Jimmy Bond, an American agent working for the Combined Intelligence Agency, and Peter Lorre as Le Chiffre. Much of the action is confined to the casino itself. A recording does exist, and I have seen it, and it's pretty shonky. A couple of years later, by the way, as everyone knows, Bob Holness portrayed James Bond on radio in an adaptation of Moonraker. Never mind a P. Can I have an M and a Q, please, Bob? Bob, of course, would later go on to host Blockbusters and play saxophone on Baker Street in Stuart McConey's Overactive Imagination. Anyway, in 1955, Fleming sold the film rights of Casino Royale to Gregory Ratoff, an actor-turned-producer, who asked the screenwriter Lorenzo Semple Jr. to knock up a workable script. Semple was later instrumental in getting the Batman TV series to air and co-wrote Papillon, which is one of my favourite films. Oh, and he would later go on to write Never Say Never Again, which I only remember for having Rowan Atkinson in it. Both Ratoff and Semple didn't care much for Bond and felt it would be better if the character were a woman, which I suppose is quite progressive for the time. That said, I can't help thinking that if this had ever managed to find its way to the screen, it would have ended up being Bond in a bikini. We'll never know, as no script survives. Unfortunately, Ratoff died in 1960 before managing to secure financial backing from any studio. The story is that soon after, Albert R. Broccoli approached Ratoff's widow and tried to purchase the Casino Royale rights. Independently of Ratoff, Broccoli had been trying to get a James Bond film project off the ground for a few years. However, enter Ratoff's former agent, Charles K. Feldman. Feldman advised Ratoff's widow against selling the rights to Broccoli and secured them for himself. He knew Broccoli and must have sniffed something in the air, realizing that this was a potentially lucrative property. Together with director Howard Hawks, Feldman tried to get a film off the ground, with his choice of Bond being Cary Grant, but it more or less floated around in development hell for a while, by which time Dr. No was released in 1962. That film was such a massive success that Feldman decided to cut his losses and tried to make a deal with Broccoli for Casino Royale. However, talks broke down and no deal could be agreed, so a couple of years later, Feldman managed to persuade Columbia Pictures to bankroll a film version, this time with a screenplay written by Ben Hecht, who'd written such films as Hitchcock's Notorious and Scarface. Feldman had decided that there was little to be gained in trying to ape the Connery films, and so envisaged Casino Royale as a Bond spoof. By the mid-60s, Bond mania was such that you couldn't walk past the cinema without seeing posters outside advertising the latest cheap imitation. Movie makers wanted to cash in on the demand for sexy spies, glamorous locations, plenty of violence, and casual misogyny. Hecht wrote several drafts of Casino Royale, which were largely faithful to the source novel, and contained nothing particularly comedic. He died of a heart attack in 1964, shortly after completing his final script. Well, it would be, wouldn't it? Pretty much the only idea of Hex that made its way into the 1967 film was the conceit of multiple MI6 agents going under the name of James Bond. The script was passed to a number of writers to work on, including Joseph Heller of Catch-22 fame, Billy Wilder and others, but the eventual screenplay credit went to Wolf Mankiewicz, John Law and Michael Sayers. Mankiewicz had worked on the screenplay for Dr. No, but had been so horrified by the finished film pre-release, he had insisted his name be removed from the credits. What a putz. John Law had worked with Michael Bentine on things like It's a Square World, and he wrote the famous Class sketch for the Frost Report. Others who more or less added their two penneth to the increasingly bloated and unworkable Casino Royale script were Woody Allen, Peter Sellers, Terry Southern, and Val Guest. As for who was to play Bond, Feldman briefly considered casting Roger Moore. He went so far as to approach Sean Connery, who asked for $1 million and was rejected. This is curious, as reportedly Sellers was later to command such a fee, plus percentage points. At one point, Terence Cooper, the rather bland, beefy actor we see in the film as Coop, was earmarked for a while to be Bond by Feldman. Cooper was one of those actors you'd see at the time popping up in endless ITV television drama series, usually playing heavies or the occasional colourless lead. Having worked previously with Peter Sellers on What's New Pussycat, of which more later, Feldman then offered Sellers the role of Bond. Sellers was unwilling at first, thinking Bond too one-dimensional and unsuited to his style. But I kind of wonder that he wasn't secretly flattered to be asked. His ego was the size of France at times. Feldman then pitched it to him that he play a character who plays Bond. That would give Sellers more to get his teeth into. It was later suggested that Sellers became distracted by the idea of playing Bond to the extent he wanted to do it straight and was irritated that the film was a comedy. They filmed mostly at Pinewood and Shepperton and in County Meath between January and October 1966. During lulls in filming, David Niven, cast as Sir James Bond, took cast and crew to watch World Cup matches. Niven, incidentally, had been Fleming's original choice to play Bond in Dr. No. It was, as they say, a hot mess. A frenetic, plotless shambles, as Niven's biographer put it. As well as Niven, Sellers and Woody Allen, other cast members included Orson Welles as Le Chiffre, Ursula Andress as Vesper Lind, Deborah Carr as Agent Mimi, and Joanna Pettit as Marta Bond. They all did their best, I suppose. Oh, and remember my old maxim. There's a marked upswing in the film's fortunes, albeit briefly, when Bernard Cribbins and John Bluth will turn up. In total, five directors were attached to the project. John Huston, Ken Hughes, Robert Parrish, Joe McGrath, and Val Guest, plus stunt coordinator Richard Talmadge. Everyone worked independently of the others without consulting each other, and thus chaos reigned. In the end, as so often happened, Sellers had tantrums. He refused to be in the same room as Orson Welles, he threatened fellow actors like Jacqueline Bisset, he hit director Joe McGrath, and generally made a tit of himself on set. He would disappear for days or weeks on end, and finally abandoned the project completely. As a result, the whole film had to be hastily reassembled, with new scenes being written and already shot footage and outtakes cobbled together. This is why so many directors and writers were involved, and so many dreadful ideas tossed into the mix. At one point, the idea of casting Danny LaRue as Marta Bond was toyed with. The finished film retained only a handful of elements of the original novel. The Baccarat scene, the bit where Bond is tortured by Le Chiffre, and there are some character names recycled but bearing no similarity to the actual characters in the book. Casino Royale was released on 13th of April 1967, 2 months before You Only Live Twice. It originally had a budget of around $4 million. By the end, this had skyrocketed to $28 million. Time magazine called it Mini Cleopatra. Still, it washed its face at the box office, turning a decent profit and ensuring a steady future income for the estate of Peter Sellers, who demanded a percentage of the film. But the movie was monstered by critics who mostly regarded it as baffling and ridiculous. The only high point, they all agreed, was the Burt Bacharach music, particularly the theme tune performed by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, and The Look of Love, performed by Dusty Springfield. Eventually, some 30 years later, Casino Royale was remade starring the then new Bond, Daniel Craig, and it was pretty much a return to the source material. I watched it again recently, wincing at that scene, and while it was enjoyable, and while I'm not making any claims for the 67 version to be re-evaluated as high art or any such tommy rot, I couldn't help feeling the 2006 remake could have benefited from a cameo by Bernard Cribbins or John Bluthal. You all know I'm right. So, all that being said, let's talk about Casino Royale.
Now, I always thought You Only Live Twice came out first, and yet You Only Live Twice is 2 months later, the one with the volcano, and it becomes, again, this... I don't know if you've ever seen the photographs of the cinema where it was the the premiere was for You Only Live Twice, but it's just enormous. It is the entire block has just been decorated, and it's just, you know, it's a huge, huge film. Written by Roald Dahl, strangely. But but you get this, and when you think about what we think of 60s James Bond, say through the filter of Austin Powers, Austin Powers takes a lot of its cues from You Only Live Twice, but it also takes a hell of a lot of cues from Casino Royale.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's kind of weird. It's actually strangely influential, despite, you know, not being the greatest film ever made. And a fortune was spent making this. You actually watched this film. I mean, I know you say you've sat down and watched it, and maybe you would never want to. You never watch it twice, as the phrase goes. But it's, you can see a fortune has been spent making this, and you kind of think, if I had £28 million, perhaps I might have done something else with it.
Yeah, I don't know what, but something to benefit mankind.
Well, yes.
Casino Royale is too much for one James Bond. Join the Casino Royale fun movement.
Mr. Bond, I'm Lieutenant Mathis of the Special Police.
Peter Sellers is James Bond.
These are my credentials.
They appear to be in order.
Ursula Andress is James Bond. David Niven is James Bond. Woody Allen is James Bond.
My doctor says I can't have bullets enter my body at any time. What if I said I was pregnant?
Joanna Pettit is James Bond.
Rather warm in here, don't you think?
Cool it, Charlie.
Casino Royale is too much for one James Bond. Orson Welles is the heaviest heavy of Smirch. Dahlia Lavi is James Bond.
I'm the new secret weapon.
James Bond! They've got us on the run with guns and knives. Fighting for our lives.
Casino Royale is too much for one James Bond.
Next.
Terrence Cooper is James Bond. Barbara Boucher is James Bond. Casino Royale is indestructibly wild.
Hello, sailor.
Indescribably funny.
Oh, you like that sort of thing, eh?
Join the Casino Royale fun movement.
So, just to give you my background on this film. I don't really have a history with this film. I've certainly seen it before I watched it for this. I couldn't tell you how many times I've seen it, and I would probably say I've probably only seen it the once all the way through prior to this, and watched bits subsequently.
I think it's the sort of film that comes on in the afternoon and you catch the end of it and go, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
And you sometimes pick it up at halfway or three quarters of the way through. I don't think many people sit down with a view to just, oh, that's on this afternoon. Or they go, oh, that's on this afternoon. Oh, it's not Daniel Craig, which is the more modern response to it, I think.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know if I had this on tape or what. Because I was hoovering up everything Sellers related back in my teens. And I think I must have taped it off TV sometime in the 90s, I guess. I sort of had it in my head, I think, that Peter Sellers was James Bond, or a sort of James, which he is a sort of James Bond in the sense that he's not James
Everybody
Bond,
is.
But he's playing a character called Evelyn Tremble, who is then, along with some other characters in this film, going under the name of James Bond. So I didn't really, because there's no real coherent plot, really, is there? It's very
it's very vague, and it's very there is one, but it's very hard to find.
It's really difficult to nail down. And so I was rewatching this last week. Mm. We're not going to go through it in a linear fashion, but you know when you get to that point in films where whatever you're holding in your hand, steady, but you know what I mean? Whatever, if you've got a pen in your hand or a book in your hand or even like an empty coffee cup, and you're sitting and you're getting increasingly agitated or... not worked up, but you're finding you're becoming more and more depressed by what you're watching, and then suddenly there's a scene, and you just think, "Oh, for God's sake!" And you just want to toss whatever's in your hand across the room, you know? And I had that my moment watching this.
I sometimes fling books in much the same way.
Yeah. So try and have a guess which bit of this film caused me to have that reaction.
Oh crikey, there's so many. I'm not quite sure. Depending on how far you got through it, I mean...
Well, all of it. I've watched all of it. Come on,
I'm professional. At what point you
I would say it was about two-thirds of the way through, maybe.
Oh, right. Okay. Because there is, you know, Sellers as Hitler, you know. That's a slightly worrying moment, you know. There is when it suddenly becomes an Indian music movie, you know. It's... I can't imagine. Go on, do tell.
Right, it's the bit that I am going to refer to as the Gerry Anderson moment.
Oh, when it turns into Stingray!
Yeah.
Yes,
the bit with the UFO and the weird floaty module thing.
Suddenly it's Stingray. Yes. Good Lord, it was that long. Right, okay, yes. Mm. The last half hour of this film, I know I don't sort of jump to the end, but the last half hour of this film is just... bonkers. It's actually after Sellers has gone.
Yeah,
it's this. I mean, this film was thrown. Well, it's like thrown together. You've got five or six, depending on your point of view, directors, all doing different things, more or less to the same ends, and somebody at the end of it has to try and tie it all together. I wanted to,
which was Val Guest, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and basically somebody had to try and turn this into something vaguely coherent. And the fact that it works sort of as a film at all is probably largely down to Val Guest. I wanted to. There's a story I wanted to mention to you, which is completely irrelevant to this. But when I was at school, we in our English class we had to put a show together, and various. Three sections of the class had to do a show, one a week. Mm-hmm. So one section did, you know, they wrote sketches and everything like that. And so we had the first week we went in and one group of people did seven or eight sketches. And it was like a comedy show, but not very funny, you know. The second week, another group of people had to do one. They did seven or eight sketches. And my English teacher, because I ended up being in charge of the third one, and the third one is that no, because I am not a manager, never have been, never will be, but in the course of our three quarters of an hour, I think he said you did 34 different, and it was just a dozen lads with a stage, being told they've got to do something with no prep whatsoever, any old idea that they could think of. Was put before the audience. And for some reason, the last half hour of Casino Royale always makes me think of that day because it was one of my biggest school time humiliations. But it just makes me think of any crap you can think of. God, let's have a seal. Let's have a seal clapping. Hooray. You know, it's kind of, what, there's Keystone Cops. Let's have them in. Oh, yeah, let's do a bit of that. Oh, God, you know. And Frankenstein. We need Frankenstein to come. Frankenstein's monster, sorry.
Dave Prowse, of course, in his film debut.
Indeed.
I just wrote on my pad in huge block letters, general arsing about.
Yeah, it's basically any shit idea.
Yeah,
and it genuinely looks as if they were making it up as they went along, which I know isn't how film works, but it does feel like that.
It briefly, when you see the American cavalry kind of riding in, it made me think momentarily of Blazing Saddles.
Mm.
You know, the end of Blazing Saddles when they all end up.
Yeah. Absolutely, and you get parachutists coming. It's just absolutely crazy.
Yeah,
it really is, and this is kind of like we've got to. it's because by this point Sellers has walked off the plot, but he's also walked off the film.
Yeah.
And somebody, and they've got no ending to the film. And I believe the guy who directed most of the Casino chaos was the second unit director, wasn't it? It was Richard Talmadge. He basically just filmed a lot of stuff, and this happened. But you almost get the impression, I can't remember which studio it was filmed in, but it's like whoever was on the site on that day, can you come in and do a couple of minutes? It's, yeah. You know, anybody.
Well, George Raft
comes in as George Raft.
The actor Jean-Paul Belmondo.
I mean, this cast is to die for, and yet somehow they are less than the sum of the parts, shall we say. But I'm not even saying it's a curate's egg anymore. it's amazingly mad, and yet somehow within all that there is this iconic stuff. I mean, within this section you get the escape sequence, which is where David Niven, God bless him, David Niven is never less than brilliant as an actor. You know, he always is giving it his all, he plays it perfectly straight, you know, he knows he's in a turkey. And they do this sequence where they go into various different pop art rooms, which each one is on screen for seconds. Each one must have taken an absolute, you know, days of people's lives to build and put together.
Absolutely.
And it's they're iconic, again, 60s, you know, nonsense design, you know, or pop art design, if you prefer. And yet somehow in the middle of all this, you get nonsense. Brilliantly fabulous. I mean, this skits on Ken Adams' set, you know, you sort of expect the big windows with the fish and all this kind of thing. And it's totally batshit crazy, quite frankly.
Well, yeah. But, okay, so let's say, because the film... I just want to mention the beginning, the right at the beginning of the film, the pre-credit sequence.
Oh,
so well. So if you didn't know otherwise in 1967... and you thought this was part of this was an Eon Productions Bond film, you know, proper Bond film, and you went to watch this in the cinema, it opens with Peter Sellers standing in an open air urinal.
Lay Beatles.
Yes. Why? What's? I mean, I know what Lay Beatles
That's
is.
That's just graffiti, isn't it?
It's just graffiti scrawled on the side.
In this pissoir, yes.
Yes. Peter Sellers and there's a French policeman with a Scottish accent.
Yes.
looking at his credentials, right? Mm. So you immediately get the measure of the film. But what the hell would you have made of that? You're thinking, good God. And then you've got the credit sequence, which is great, and the great music and all the rest of it. But then it goes straight into the John Huston directed sequence where John Huston himself is one of the is playing
M
with heads of other international intelligence agencies in a car driving to Sir James Bond's Scottish home. And again, you might be forgiven for thinking, oh, okay, this could be a proper Bond film. But then
have you seen Skyfall?
I have seen Skyfall, yeah.
Do you not feel that there's a slight influence of this film in Skyfall, with that whole Scottish house where...
Oh, maybe, yes, I never thought of that.
It just feels there are these little tendrils that come out from this film that sort of get referenced. I mean...
But you don't have, in Skyfall, you don't have like a pack of lions or lions. sitting on the roof of the car and the theme from Born Free playing.
No. Although the musical cues from other films would feature quite a lot in the Roger Moore films, you see.
Oh.
So, again, there are little influences that crept in when Roger Moore's films were getting more, some people say camp, but certainly the comedic elements were building up, and it was the team that were making them. At that stage, you started to get, I mean, he does, is it California Girls when he's skiing down a hill in his last film, which A View to a Kill. There's a scene where he skis down a slope.
Oh, see,
and you get that little hint of that tune, you know, the California Girls. So they started doing that. And it's kind of interesting to me that, weirdly, you get things like the poison pen letter, which they actually make a big... In the Q scene in the middle of this, which I know is, again, we're going all over the place with this. But That's seen as one of the better scenes in the film, but weirdly, it resembles the later Q scenes that they did with Roger Moore very much. It has the same almost setup. There's more jokes, more deliberate jokes in this. But generally, the way it's done is very much like those films later. And again, they make the poison pen letter line, which is also nicked from Carry On Spying a few years earlier.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. I would argue if you're going to make a James Bond spoof, actually Carry On Spying generally works better
yes.
than this.
Oh, yeah.
Morning, Q.
Good morning, Fordyce. New man. Mm.
If I could bother you for the signature, sir.
Signature, yes.
I shouldn't use that pen, sir. The moment the nib touches the paper, it releases a stream of poisonous gas into the writer's eye.
Heavens, what do they think of next? Mm. Well, go near that. I suppose it would come in quite useful if you ever wanted to send anyone a poison pen
letter. Yes, all our new men say that. I usually reply, I don't wish to know that. Kindly leave MI5.
Yes,
sir, we have a very highly developed sense of humour down here.
It isn't the only thing that's highly developed down here.
I've never been a huge James Bond fan.
No.
I've probably seen most of them over the years at some point, or bits of most of them. Never really got into them particularly. I much prefer the grittier, you know, the Le Carré style.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you actually think about this. Peter Sellers is wearing Harry Palmer glasses.
That's true. Yeah, Harry Palmer, Ypres Farlan, Funeral in Berlin. I love them, you know, and Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Deadly Affair. And those are my spy films, okay?
Although Harry Palmer is Saltzman. So,
that's true.
You know,
but I do know. Yeah, I mean, you can't avoid the fact that the Roger Moore Bond films got increasingly more comedic, I suppose, as they went on. I seem to remember. Is there a pre-credit sequence in one of the Bond films? Is it The Spy Who Loved Me, where he somehow from a helicopter or a small plane drops a character in a wheelchair into a factory chimney or something ridiculous. Yeah,
For Your Eyes Only. Strange enough, an actor who is in this film is in that film. So, in fact, he's the man in the wheelchair.
Oh, who's that?
It's the bald guy who is. Oh God, I can never remember his name. But he's also in Empire Strikes Back. He's the famously bald actor.
I'm sure there's more than one bald actor.
Yes, it's Telly Savalas. No. It's... Oh, I can't remember his name.
Okay. The Houston-directed opening sequence, if you like, of this film. John Huston plays M in this really terrible, rusty syrup that he's got on his head. And he wanted Robert Morley to play M. And I'm no fan of Robert Morley, as listeners will know, but he'd have made a better M than bloody Huston. That accent made groundskeeper Willie's accent sound like, I don't know, Alex Ferguson.
John Huston has made some of the greatest films ever made.
Oh, yes.
And yet his section of this is not a high point.
No. Oh, look, don't get me wrong. The Man Who Would Be King is a brilliant film.
Yeah.
Treasure of the Sierra Madre and... all them,
but this whole laboured sequence, I genuinely believe, is to feed that heirloom joke.
Yes.
That whole purpose of that first 20 minutes of the film is to feed that joke. And I think that's part of the problem. It's very, very laboured. I think Casino Royale thinks it's funnier than it is. And I think that's something that sort of damns it throughout. It just doesn't quite manage to be as sharp or as funny as it believes it is, and sometimes the gags are just risible. But I think the other thing, though, I think it's strange how things can connect, if you like. Sorry, that's the word I'm looking for. Thank you. It's strange how things connect in the sense that you've got Sellers and Niven from the Pink Panther, and you've also got Burt Kwok later on. You know, you've got the Richard Williams animations, which are lovely at the beginning, the opening credits and everything like that. So you've got that sort of seam of Pink Pantherness coming through.
Graham Stark as well.
Yeah. And you feel that there's a kind of, oh, well, if they're in this, that must be good. And it's like they're automatically going to be good, you know. And And you get weird things like the... I don't know if you know much about Doctor Strangelove.
Of course, I do.
But Doctor Strangelove... Yeah, of course you do, yes. But you know how they talk about the custard pie fight?
Yeah, yeah.
That was decided not to be done.
Yeah.
But there is a custard... Well, there's an equivalent of a custard pie fight in here. You get the fire extinguisher sequence. Mm. And, of course, the chaos at the end almost feels like, oh, well, you know, Kubrick was going to do it. Why don't we? And again, you sort of wonder, although, like I say, he was off the project at this point, you kind of wonder whether any of this comes from Sellers himself.
Yeah, so Sellers does get... it is credited as having some input in the script. Mm. I don't know what to what extent, but he was... Because obviously, as I said earlier, this is produced by Charles K. Feldman, who also... was behind What's New Pussycat, the year before, and he that had been a hit, and there's a lot of echoes of What's New Pussycat in this film, because obviously we've got we've got Sellers, but you've also got Woody Allen, who actually, Woody Allen, to me, he's made a handful of good films. He's made a classic film in Annie Hall, which is one of my all time favourites. But I've never been a particular Woody Allen fan apart from Annie Hall. But in this, he's quite a good physical comedian in this, actually.
He holds that last half hour together quite well.
He does. He does.
I mean, he's only in there's a scene earlier with the against the wall joke, which is quite funny. And that's the thing. There are moments which are quite funny every so often, but they are very few and far between.
Well, they are, but so you've got Sellers, Woody Allen, Ursula Andress was also in What's New Pussycat. You've got Peter O'Toole.
And Dr. No, of course.
Yes, and Dr. No. Peter O'Toole was in What's New Pussycat. He's briefly, very briefly, in Casino Royale.
Excuse me, are you Richard Burton?
No, I'm Peter O'Toole.
Then you're the finest man that ever breathed.
Oh!
God bless you.
Thank you.
Burt Bacharach wrote the title song, and again, you've got the Richard Williams title sequence, What's New Pussycat. The spirit as well of What's New Pussycat is sort of beating here as well.
Was Sellers with Britt Eklund at the time?
Yes.
Right. Because she did Golden Gun later, but I just wondered whether whether he was sort of trying to sort of get her onto the project at that point. Again, who knows? Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me. So there's some isolated good gags, good jokes. They are few and far between. One of the few that made me actually laugh out loud, not heartily, but
no.
You know, it was a titter. Because at the beginning, when we first meet Sir James Bond, i.e. David Niven, he's got a bit of a stammer, hasn't he?
Yes.
And then when M gets blown up and Bond is called back to MI6 in London, the stammer is gone. And he says to Miss Moneypenny, "Let me know if I stammer. I haven't got time for that now." Which I thought, that's a good gag. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. But that's the thing you also get in the... my other favourite is the Berlin Wall gag. I just think
with Cribbins.
Vladek Shebal gets blown up and then they all come through the wall. And the hole is where I just think that's quite sweet.
I thought you were going to say the gag where Bernard Cribbins in London, cabby Bernard Cribbins drives Marta Bond to Berlin.
Yes. But again, there's a lot of connections coming back to wearing my other hat, as it were. There's a lot of connections with television of the time. It actually looks a lot like a lot of 60s television of the time. So you've got, there's a weird scene with the Scalextric set around some women in a kind of secret lair kind of thing. Mm. Now that makes me think of The Prisoner. The secret lair looks just like The Prisoner.
It does, doesn't it?
But also, they look like they're dressed from Shadow in UFO. You know. And you get... there's a whole sequence in there with the chasing of the milk lorry and the girl in the Jaguar who's chasing... And that just makes me think of the prisoner episode, The Girl Who Was Death, which I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I have seen it, yes.
Well. Yeah. And
Is that the one with the pint glass with...
Yes, which had just been poisoned.
That's right, yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it's just, to me, that looks beautiful. There are moments in this that look beautiful. That idea of sort of 60s landscapes, where, you know, with the wide shots and there aren't motorways yet and before a lot of these villages. At times, it looks beautiful. This film, it actually has
particularly the house in Berlin, which is a homage to sort of early German expressionism.
Oh, yeah, like, absolutely.
Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or something. It was the house that Anna Quell and Ronnie Corbett seem to be living in.
Yes, that's the sequence in the film that I most enjoy, just because it does have all that those links back to silent cinema, you know. Yeah. And there's even a John Steed gag with the bowler hat with John Bluthal.
John Bluthal. There we go.
Well, yeah, but it's just, he has the bowler hat on with the gun in it and it goes off and it gives him a headache. And it's, and again, I actually wonder with him whether they forgot he'd been in the other bit when they cast him again.
No, well, John Bluthal, this is a thing, right? And I've already said that, you know, a film is much better whenever John Bluthal turns up. He was supposed to be in the film a lot more than he was. Because obviously the director, Joe McGrath, who had... worked with Sellers quite a bit in the earlier days and went on to work with him more. Joe McGrath came on board and he'd worked a lot, you know, I guess you could say John Bluthal was sort of part of his rep company, if you like. And so McGrath had John Bluthal playing multiple roles, apparently, in this film. And Sellers, being Sellers...
wanted to do them.
I think he was a little bit, maybe a little bit of jealousy crept in because Bluthal's such an accomplished comedy actor.
Yeah.
Character actor. And Sellers more or less fired Bluthal from the film.
Right.
So there were other parts that Bluthal played which were cut or removed or not even put in, shall we say.
Considering how short they were of footage, it's surprising.
Yeah. Well, same thing happened because... I don't know, about, 7 years later, maybe? Sellers and Milligan recorded this LP about Watergate. Not very good. Okay. Not very good. It was just pre-Return of the Pink Panther, so Sellers was doing anything.
He's innocent of Watergate. He's innocent, I know. Nixon,
that's it. Innocent,
so please don't let him go. Yeah, I know.
That's it. And Bluthal was on that LP, but again, Sellers removed a lot of his contribution from the LP.
Wow.
Down to, I guess, professional jealousy. But of course, there is one of the greatest moments in comedy cinema history between Bluthal and Sellers, which is the Minky scene from Return of the Pink Panther. And that, indeed, you know, for that we can be thankful.
So basically, as with many things, it depends what mood Peter Sellers is in that particular day.
Yes.
Of all of them... it's kind of weird that he became the film star, is it? Or is it not? Because I know they all had cinema appearances. I don't suppose Milligan was ever going to be leading man material, and neither was Harry Seacombe. But
no.
It's just kind of weird that Sellers, I suppose the most conventional looking, went on to have this... But he was a film star. He was a massive film star in the 60s, wasn't he?
It was never in the script for him to be a leading man.
Mm.
Or sorry, not a leading man, but a leading man in films, but not a matinee idol. But obviously, he had these heart attacks in 64. Yeah. He then slimmed down. He was taking all sorts of pills and diet pills and God knows what. Mm. Slimmed down. Had a lot of work done here and there, I think, as well. And it's quite difficult to say, but he really looks svelte in this film.
Well, he's doing the leading man matinee idol thing, isn't he? But again, he's playing that, I suspect.
He more or less plays it straight. This film. He does.
He takes it very seriously in the sequence just after he's introduced. I mean, the weird thing about this is he's introduced at 44 minutes into the film, apart from that tiny fragment at the beginning, which is there basically to say, "This is a Peter Sellers film," just in case, because you're not going to see him now for about 3/4 of an hour.
Well, that's what they used to do with Columbo occasionally. Do you know, because obviously, famously, Columbo would never turn up at the beginning of Columbo. He'd turn up 20, 25 minutes in after the murder had been committed, you know?
Yes.
But there's the odd episode of Columbo where, for whatever reason, the murder takes longer. And so in those instances, panicky producers of Columbo would insert a little shot of Columbo right at the beginning of the episode, taking his dog for a walk or something like that, which is totally unrelated to the subsequent story. But it's just to keep the audience on board, basically.
So, mind them what they're watching.
Absolutely. So you have that Peter in the pissoir at the beginning of the film, just to keep people in the audience, keep them on the seats. And we say that Sellers plays it pretty straight. There's a couple of moments where the comedy actor shows its head, if you like.
Yes.
The moment when he's in the shower, with his particularly hairy back, and who is it that turns the shower on? Is it Vespa Lynd? Is it Ursula Andress?
Yes, it's Solandress. Yes.
And we have yes, he squeals.
Vespa, I've given this game a lot of thought. And when I go into that casino tonight, I'm going to sit down opposite Le Chief, look him straight in the eye and say...
Again, I was thinking about this. Basically, if you ignore the opening fragment, he turns up at 44 minutes and he's gone by an hour and a half. He's in that middle three quarters of an hour, but he's not even in all of that because for 17 minutes they go off and follow Matterbond in India. And then the Berlin sequence. And so really, there's two 15-minute segments. It's about the length of a Gun Show episode, more or less, of Sellers in the entire film.
And well, there's the bit that you've touched on where Evelyn Tremble, the character, adopts maybe, I don't know, five or six different voices throughout the film, particularly when he's doing that dressing up box routine for Ursula Andress, where he dresses as a military officer, the obligatory camp man,
Hello Sailor,
Hitler, Napoleon, Toulouse-Lautrec, as he would do in Revenge of the Pink Panther.
Yeah.
That scene's, to me, that's, you know, neither here nor there. It was unnecessary. It doesn't add anything to the film. Not many things add to the film, but that scene was the only bit of the film that Spike Milligan liked, apparently. And he phoned Sellers after he'd seen the film and he asked him why the rest of the film wasn't like that bit. So I don't know what Spike wanted. Just
2 hours of Peter Sellers trying on different outfits.
Like Peter Sellers in an episode of Copycats just doing different
Mr. Ben the movie. That's what you never know, it might have worked.
Yeah, I know.
I think the cleverest scene is possibly the spy gadgets one, because it's definitely putting in the knife into the main series and it's played quite straight. But I think the nicest scene with Sellers for me is that scene where he goes into the office of the casino and he looks through the window and I can't remember, what does he say? It's not like Basingstoke, but what was the name of the place he normally plays cards? And it was the innocence on his face. It was so beautifully played. It was just when he just looks in wonder at the actual casino. I just think that was a moment in the film that just sort of stuck out for me as just a beautiful little moment of proper Sellers acting, if you see what I mean. And of course he ruins it by doing that strange Indian voice when he does the Indian and Chinese voices when he's talking to, and you just think, oh god, here we go again. You know, when you I watch a lot of old television from that era, and occasionally you just have to say, yeah, sorry, this is in it.
Talking about things sticking out in that office sequence. What about that tiger's tongue, that stuffed tiger's tongue? Hell was all that about?
Somebody probably thought it was funny.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem with a lot of Casino Royale. A lot of the time, you just get the impression that somebody on the day thought that would be funny. I think, to a certain extent, that happens in the later Bond films as well with Roger Moore. It's kind of, everybody's having so much fun that someone suggests a joke and they, oh yeah, or when they're editing even, maybe, I don't know. But it just, sometimes you think, somebody should have said, really? Do you think? You know.
Okay. I mean, the just back to, you're absolutely right about him doing the Indian and the Chinese accents to quote proverbs. The character's being quite passag at Le Chiffre's tricks as well, isn't he? So he's just, and obviously this is Le Chiffre played by Orson Welles, and obviously the majority of the sequence, both stars were filmed separately.
They do manage a two-shot. That's the thing that gets me. I can never decide whether it's a fake two-shot and it's whether it's been, you know, done with inserts, but there is a two. I always thought there was no two-shot at all, so I was quite surprised.
Now, I think they did get, I might be wrong, people might correct me on this, I think there is a tiny amount of footage that did capture both of them on screen together until Sellers saw his backside and decided he didn't want to be in the same room as Orson Welles. And the rumour is that Sellers felt slighted when Princess Margaret came on set and ran straight up to speak to Orson Welles and pretty much snubbed him. Which, yeah, I mean, look, Sellers and Margaret knew each other very well, so they say. So admit there may be something in that.
Any chance, this is an aside, but have you actually watched the new Beatles documentary, the one that was that Peter the Lord of the Rings chap?
Yeah, Peter Jackson. You mean
Peter Jackson?
Get back.
Have you seen that?
Oh, absolutely.
You've seen the 2 minutes the Sellers is in it.
Absolutely.
There's a good 8-hour program for you.
Oh dear, that's just makes my socks roll up and down my legs with cringy embarrassment.
I just wondered whether you'd seen it, because you just kind of think, is that what Sellers is that on that day? Because it's like, I know the Beatles, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, he looks so awkward and uncomfortable.
These people are slightly more famous than me. Yeah. I just wondered if that was part of it. You know, Orson Welles is slightly more famous.
No, undoubtedly. I'm sure there was a number of factors at play. Because I think Sellers was originally, before Orson Welles arrived on set, Sellers was looking forward to it, because I think he was a fan of a lot of Orson Welles' work. And and then, you know, Orson Welles turns up and is this force of nature, of course, and he's performing all these magic tricks, and he's got all these people sort of enthralled to him, and Sellers is probably thinking, hey, hang on, this is my gig. And that was the beginning of the end, really.
And he's allowed to do all his magic tricks as part of the script, as part of the plot.
Yeah.
It's like they're indulging him because he's Orson Welles.
And that would have pissed Sellers off as well, of course.
Yeah. Well, let's get the show off the ground. Keep your hand in place, madam, and continue to ascend. Into thin air.
Don't take your eyes from her, not one of you. It is by your perfect concentration. The young lady remains floating in thin air. Oh, excuse me, madam. Sorry to keep you hanging around.
Okay, just a few sort of little uncredited appearances in this film, which I want to touch on now, before I forget. Okay.
Okay.
Ian Hendry's in this film.
Is he?
Yeah.
Blimey, he was
but
Biden.
You wouldn't, you don't actually, well, you do see him, but you don't see him.
Right.
Apparently more footage with him was cut from the film. But you know that bit where we see Vesper Lynd in her, I guess it's her kitchen in her apartment.
Oh, is he the body?
He's the body under the sheet that goes down the chute. Yeah.
Well, that explains why he left the Avengers then.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's a claim to fame, isn't it? Yeah.
So, because famously Ian Hendry was resentful of Michael Caine all his life, wasn't he, in terms of...
his career. Well,
his career.
Yeah.
And
I think that's always the way, though. When somebody that is your contemporary, they go off and have this career and you go off and have that career, and you feel, we started in the same place. Why isn't it me?
Yeah.
I feel that must grate with a lot of careers, really. You know, I mean, you hear about, in cinema generally, you hear about people's feuds, you know, the feuds that they had for donkey's years, and you kind of think a lot of it comes down to these professional jealousies, really.
Yeah, but you can imagine Hendry thinking, okay, I'm gonna make it in the films.
going to be a big star?
I'm going to be bigger than Kane. And then he ends up a body under a sheet in Casino Royale.
Oh, dear.
You see Colin Gordon as well, briefly, playing the casino director. So yes. Sellers reunited with Colin Gordon, because Colin Gordon, of course, is someone else from the original Pink Panther film. He was Tucker, who was Clouseau's assistant, I suppose, in the Pink Panther.
And famously a number two twice.
Of course. Again, it's just...
What I love about that era, actually, this film... many of the British films of that era, but also the British television of that era, is these regular actors who you just see turning up. It's part of the joy of that, watching television from that era, is sort of joining those dots and trying to work out who's going to be in it this week and who was in that. And, oh, he's got a bit part in this, but he was in that. I love all that.
Yeah.
It's part of the joy of that era. It feels like... The 60s was kind of, there was this big sort of theatrical club that they all belonged to, really, and everybody knew everybody. I'm sure it was nothing like that whatsoever, but it feels like they all knew each other and I've got a couple of days on my film, and if you do a bit on my film, I'll do a bit on your film. And it just feels beautifully connected like that, in a way that sometimes modern television doesn't, you know, it and modern cinema sort of doesn't. Nowadays, they seem to build it around an actor. But I just like those connections. And I'm sure, I mean, obviously people still have careers like that, but for some reason it feels more intimate. Probably because the British film industry was still quite active then, whereas now it is just telly, really, you know.
Yeah, well, people like that are never going to lead a film, like Jeffrey Belden.
Mm.
They can probably make half a dozen films a year and it turn up in the same number of television shows, if not more.
Yeah. It's when you think about people like Sid James and how many films they turn up with, doing serious, doing comedy, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously he does the Carry On films later, but, you know, he's in something like Quatermass, you know, the Quatermass 2 film, I think he's in. And it's just... And so you see him playing a villain in Hell Drivers, you know, sort of playing one of the drivers in Hell Drivers.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I love Hell Drivers. I think.
Great.
Again, Alfie Bass as well, strangely.
So, and Prisoner Connection, of course. McGoohan.
Yeah. And Sean Connery. Sean Connery. However briefly.
And Pink Panther, or at least the Clouseau films, Herbert Lom.
Yeah. You see, it is, and for me, that's part of the joy of watching. I think that was that thing about, I mean, this film would have come on an afternoon and I would have probably watched it then. I suspect that's when I first saw it, actually, when I think about it now. But it's just that thing of you would sit down and, I mean, I love Hell Drivers because I saw it one wet afternoon in a summer holiday. And it's just all these people popping up, with William Hartnell's in there.
William Hartnell?
David
McCallum?
David McCallum, of course, yes. You know, and it just all connects. I mean, Stanley Baker, obviously, but, you know, and then Stanley Baker goes off and makes Zulu, and there's Michael Caine. All these dots to be joined.
Yes.
I just think it's a fabulous, fabulous time. And somehow, maybe, films like Casino Royale sort of brought down, totally destroyed the British film industry in some ways by that sort of indulgence. Because, I mean, after this... the British film industry starts moving into the sort of films you're going to talk about next week, the spin-offs from the TV shows. And I feel that because we've had Cleopatra earlier in the 60s as well, and it starts to feel that it's losing its way. It becomes more dependent on American money. I mean, it's obviously great films were made in the 70s in Britain, you know, like Superman, Star Wars, all that kind of thing, Alien. But they sort of don't feel quite as British somehow. And somehow, again, I know there were other films after this, but this feels like possibly every time an American producer said, so you want to make a British film? And they'd say, yeah, but Casino Royale. Really?
Very good point.
I would like to play Baccarat. I use the Evelyn Tremble method.
Oh, you read Tremble? I thought he'd only published a few paperback editions.
Well, I have an autographed first edition. A bit dog-eared now, mind you. I've been through it a few times, but it nevertheless has a certain
uninformed quality.
Six à la pompe et neuf à la montre.
La Bonska.
Aren't you a little out of your depth, Mr. Vaughan? In the last 20 minutes, I have ruined two Greeks and a Maharaja.
No, Mr. Vaughan, we aren't playing for marbles. The night is young, and the rose garden is already littered with my victims.
After the card game, which is central to the story of Casino Royale, even if, you know, most of it now seems to basically be based around this mother's help and what was it, the thing for the needy young girl, helpful to needy young girls. This seems to be a thread that runs through the film as well. But basically you get the torture sequence, you get the dream sequence where Ursula Andress basically machine guns everybody, the Scots guards, and
including Peter O'Toole.
Including Peter O'Toole. And of course that's where we get that weird help with Sellers, and that's pretty much the end of the film. We do get that strange Formula 3 or whatever it is scene,
which was dropped in. Yeah. It was an outtake or something that was dropped in because they needed some linking bit.
To get from point A to point B in the plot. So, and that, again, that's where you think, yep, this is falling apart. And from that point, after the dream sequence, I mean, the dream sequence is incredibly nicely done. It's again, a proper bit of 60s pop art, you know, with the little bits of frames coming into the shots. The way it's composed on screen is delightful. There's some beautiful art direction in there. But then we just move on to that last half hour, which we talked about earlier, which is chaos on screen with a hint of Carry On Spying.
Mm-hmm.
And Valentine Dial, of course.
And Valentine Dial, who obviously we don't see. We hear, who is Dr. Noah.
Noah.
God's sake.
I think Dr. Noah is also in Carry On Spying, but I'm not sure about that. I know it's not Dr. Yes. So.
Well, Dr. Noah is Woody Allen's character, isn't he? Woody Allen is Jimmy Bond, who is the nephew of Sir James Bond. God, that's confusing.
But we also get a weirdly, I mean, if you're talking about, I like connections, so, you know, you've got the silhouette chair looks just like Battlestar Galactica 10 years later, weirdly, maybe the same chair. You know, you get the walk amok, if we can't run amok, we'll walk amok line, which is quite, it's a very Woody Allen. You get germ warfare, which feels weirdly, it slightly foretells, if you like, the germ warfare plot of this is a little bit like what happens in the George Lazenby James Bond film a couple of years later, the same kind of plot idea. You know, I feel that also the UFO landing in Trafalgar Square makes me think of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the last book. So there's all sorts of things that you start to think, well, maybe Douglas Adams saw this film and subconsciously sort of thought, oh, it's an image. You know, there's a lot of really interesting imagery, if you like, in the entire film that has fed into other things. But overall, 400, we should have 400 tiny little time pills running through this entire, every time I have a different thought in the middle of a sentence. You'll love that when you come to edit this. But every time I have a different thought in the middle of a sentence, there'll be a 39.
Yes.
38. Because this is how my brain works, actually. Maybe Casino Royale is basically the cinematic equivalent of how I think. You know, it's had more influence on me than I realise, but it's just, it is batshit crazy, and maybe so am I.
A world free of poverty and pestilence and war. A world where all men are created equal. Where a man, no matter how short, can score with a top broad. Where each man, regardless of race, creed, color, gets free dental work. And a chance, a subscription buying, of all the good things in life.
But Noah, you are for all this?
No, I'm against all this.
Oh, I love politics. To your future.
I'll drink to that. My very special champagne.
With your very special pill in it.
What are you talking about?
It looks like an aspirin, it tastes like an aspirin, but it isn't an aspirin, and you just swallowed it.
You're lying.
398 more of those little pills to go off. Have a real bomb of an evening.
Alka-Seltzer.
Oh, by the way, you said, so the bald man whose name you've forgotten, who was in the wheelchair that got dropped down into a factory chimney from For Your Eyes Only. Of course,
have you found him?
No, I haven't, but I found someone else. John Wells played Dennis Thatcher in For Your Eyes Only. And John Wells turns up in this in the best scene in the film, which is the MI5 training school. Or MI6 training school. I'm not sure. Is it MI6 or MI5? MI6,
well,
I guess.
Well, I think it varies.
Yeah. But it's John Wells giving off very strong vibes of the, you know, the rude tailors from The Fast Show.
Oh, yes, yes.
Suits you, sir. Well,
it's funny, actually. One of the things I did write down was it feels in some ways like a sketch film, if you see what I mean. It's a series of sketches. It's not a portmanteau film by any means, although obviously the four or five or six directors does sort of might make you feel like it's a bit of a portmanteau film.
Yes.
But actually it's a lot more of a lot of sketches thrown together. And, you know, it's kind of like Alexandra Bastido turns up for no very good reason. So you get that scene with the Scotsman doing the games or the throwing the ball thing. With David Niven right at the beginning.
Mm.
And it's labored, it's slow, it's not particularly funny, you know, but it feels like if it was a Fast Show sketch, you'd sort of, that's that, and then you move on. And I feel that in many ways, that's what the film does feel like now. It feels, watching it, you feel, oh, well, you could actually, you know, the chapters on the DVD, if you actually bothered to buy the DVD.
Yeah.
If you had the, you kind of watch that sketch and then you watch this sketch, and it doesn't, I mean, there are attempts, and again, this is Val Guest at his very best, trying very hard to bring everything together. John Hollis, by the way, sorry, I'm just in the middle of a sentence again, haven't I? So, John Hollis was the actor I was thinking of, sorry, who's also in this, but there we are.
Okay. Well, you're saying about the sketchy nature of a lot of these scenes. You mentioned that the bit with David Niven and the large concrete cannonballs, aren't they, basically?
Yeah.
That the there's this ridiculous scene. I could see something like that in some shape or form turning up in Michael Bentine's It's a Square World.
Yeah.
You know?
Again, I mean, I didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to make this connection, but do you feel that some ways it does sort of feel like there is somebody who's a fan of the Goons working on the script? It sort of feels slightly mad enough, if you see what I mean, to the workings of Milligan's mind could have come up with something that went this
well
crazy.
Sellers has got some involvement somewhere, so probably Sellers, because Sellers was very influenced by Milligan, obviously, but in the worst way, I think, a lot of the time.
Oh, they indulged
the more indulgent side of Milligan. Mm. And Joe McGrath, obviously, was, you know, he worked on a show called Fred back in the day, so Joe McGrath was involved, but there's no quality control.
No.
Is there?
God, no.
There's nobody there with a clipboard saying, right, we're getting rid of that bit, we're taking out that bit. No, we're not having that line. Just whatever, let's just throw it all together.
Well, I suppose when you're spending 28 million of somebody else's money, it's very difficult to say we need to lose all that.
Yes.
You know? And, I mean, basically someone, you know, poor old Val Guest, if you like, was bought in to say, right, make some sense of this. And the fact that he managed to make as much sense of it as he did is quite fascinating. Like I say, there are little bits of plot that drop in. It's like, so, you know, the fact is that someone in the early bit mentions Berlin, and then there's another mention of Berlin, and then they go off to India for 10 minutes. But, you know, but oh yes, we will eventually go to Berlin because it's in the plot, sort of. There is a couple of the James Bond guidebooks that do attempt to make a sort of coherent plot out of this. If you actually go on the Wikipedia page to sort of just read the plot of this, somebody somewhere has tried. But actually, when you mention the 67 Casino Royale films, people roll their eyes. Like I say, genuinely, there are people who love it. They absolutely adore it. They find it's kind of this notion of the 60s that people have. Our vision of the 60s is sometimes guided by very small moments in the 60s. It's the Beatles, it's Carnaby Street, it's a film like Casino Royale. Sometimes people think all films of the 60s looked like this.
Yeah.
And I suspect that its reputation, I mean, the fact that it did make, like you said in your intro, it didn't lose money. A lot of people must have gone and seen it and enjoyed it. And I don't know.
Yeah, but was that not first week or weekend takings in terms of people thinking it was a proper canon James Bond film?
I suppose they take the dollars where they can.
Yeah.
But I mean, looking back now, you just think, I say I've watched it twice in the last 2 weeks for this. And so that's
good.
4 hours a month. Yes. But it's a long time since I'd previously watched it. I think it had been on TV a long time ago. It's a difficult film to recommend to anybody. It's kind of one of those you need to see it to believe it kind of films. And it's a difficult film to like, and it's a difficult film to say this is brilliant. But certainly as an example of 60s pop art somethingness, or even just this sheer indulgence in chaos, people, again, getting back to wearing my other hat, people talk about the last episode of The Prisoner as being a bit mad and chaotic. But this feels like the cinematic equivalent, really. It's almost like we got to a point where nobody really knew how to finish these things. It's just, you know, I mean, the cowboys and the, oh God, it's a film I've watched more than twice. So there are some films I can say I definitely haven't done that. So I must go back to it occasionally. And some of the imagery has stuck with me, but overall it's a hard film to love.
Well, I was watching it last Friday, Friday afternoon. And my finger was hovering over the remote all the time, terrified of my children walking in and watching this shameful film. This abomination. It's not an abomination.
No, it's all right. I'm just watching some porn. It's all right. No, I'm not watching. No, I'm not watching that. No,
because they know. My kids, who both are, you know, one's 16, one's 18, so, you know, they.
Yeah.
But they know that I'm into stuff like this. They know that the old man's living in the past, I suppose, shall we say. But I don't know how I would have explained to my son, you know, why there's that silly slapstick fight with the fire extinguisher. It's interesting because Anna Quayle and Ronnie Corbett in Berlin, and Anna Quayle, to me, has the standout scene in A Hard Day's Night, the little bit where she's talking to John Lennon.
Yes.
I always love her for that. But she's brilliant in this. And, of course, Ronnie Corbett's in this. And you think, people now just think of Ronnie Corbett as a star of the 70s and the 80s, really, don't they? Two Ronnies, sorry, always wearing, you know, a Pringle jumper and all the rest of it. But, you know, he was big in the 60s. Wow. And his career was developing. And, his star was in the ascendancy. Mm. And the same time that he was presumably filming Casino Royale, he was starring in his first sitcom, which was called No, That's Me Over Here.
Is it slightly later than The Frost Report as well?
Yes, it was slightly later. Yeah, it was written by Barry Cryer, Graham Chapman, and Eric Idle. And then after that, he would go on to, he'd be in a few other sitcoms, and he was also in, he was one of the regulars on Frost on Sunday a couple of years later. So, you know, his career was growing. But it is weird to see him in this film.
Le Chiffre is trying to raise money by selling his unique art collection.
Why does he need money?
He's a compulsive gambler, that's why. And he is using organization funds for his gambling.
You mean Smirsch?
Smirsch. If he does not pay off his debts, he will be liquidated.
Liquidated? Who by?
By them.
You mean
shh? You're so like your mother, you're driving me mad.
Well, you haven't got far to go.
Come to me, my little master. Come to me, come!
About time you were back in your box, isn't it?
You must forgive me. I lose control of myself. I'm a mad fool, mad.
You want an argument?
Remember, forget everything I tell you.
My lips are sealed.
Lips? Don't say that word.
Run along, son.
I mean, I like the German expressionist scene. That's the scene I look forward to when I'm sitting through this film. I always think, ah, yes, but the Berlin bit, you'll like that.
Yeah.
And if you do like your Dr. Caligari, you know, it's a beautiful nod to that. I know that section was only directed, that was the only section that, what's his name? Where's his name gone? Ken Hughes. It's the only section
yes.
that he did.
Yes,
but it's a beautiful thing, really. I mean, it has the terrible. That's the only time I've gone around with a John line, which is possibly the most awful one.
Yes.
In the film.
Yes,
the bad toilet gag, if you like.
yeah.
But you know, as you say, lifted by Cribbins and.
Yes.
And that modern girl Matterbond is you know, just, holding her own in that, although
she's all right. What's her name? Joanna Pettit. She's all right in this.
I thought, God, is it only 2 hours?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
considering a lot of the films of that time were 90 minutes, and didn't outstay the welcome. But a 2-hour movie in the '60s, you know, it's M.I.K. It's not Waterworld length, you know, but. It's not the Lord of the Rings, you know. It's 2 hours, which is standard running time for a film. But it does seem at times very slow, and I think it is that problem is that the jokes take a while to pay off, and they're very languidly and very slowly delivered, and they're not really worth it. Like I say, the heirloom really isn't worth.
It's incredibly baggy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just want to mention Angela Schuyler. Who's got a small role in this as Buttercup. She's in the bathtub testing the temperature of the water just like she did for her daddy.
Oh, God, yes. I was trying to skim over the slightly worrying 16 to 19-year-olds, 11 daughters or whatever it was, and that one in the bath testing. Yeah, that is almost so 60s sexist, it's frighteningly bad. And,
But Angela Schuyler, I'm singled her out because we covered Doctor in Trouble a couple of weeks ago. And, of course, she's a central character in that. Later went on to marry Leslie Phillips. She was also in On Her Majesty's...
Testing his bathwater.
Yes, I'm sure she was. And she was later in On Her Majesty's Secret Service as well.
There you go.
You've got Derek Nimmo, the lovable and one-dimensional Derek Nimmo. Oh, the music, we haven't really talked. I mean, the theme tune is wonderful. Although the theme tune is
Well, you have to save, you do have to save the best to last. It is a high point for people.
Yeah, but it's not a James Bond theme, is it? The Casino Royale theme is not a Bond theme, is it? It doesn't sound like, it's not got that Bond sound to it.
No. Well, of course, at that stage, it would have all been John Barry, wouldn't it?
True.
And big horns, Mr. Horn, big horns, as it were, But nevertheless, so it doesn't sound like the other Bond films of the time, but it is actually, it's a very enjoyable soundtrack. I mean, I actually like the lyric version at the end of the film. I do like that.
It's very good, that. Yeah.
It actually sort of says more about the James Bond thing in some ways, you know, than a lot of the actual film does, you know, because it said James Bond, it's terribly hot. It gets stuck in your head, that one, I must admit.
The Look of Love is a beautiful song. Love that song, Dusty Springfield.
There's a strangely peculiar thing of late 60s Bond films, even if they're not official, having an absolutely timeless love song in them. Because... Mm-hmm. Louis Armstrong's All the Time in the World is the closing music On Her Majesty's. And I actually feel that there are hints of Casino Royale in On Her Majesty's Secret Service as well. It's almost like, you know, maybe it's the same crew. I don't know. But you do feel connections. And it's even like the whole scene with this kilt where someone writes on his leg in On Her Majesty's is... very much like the kilt scenes in this, you know. I feel connections somehow. There's because there's a pan under the table where someone's rubbing James's leg with the kilt and things like that.
Mm.
There are weird connections with the other films in here, which considering, you know, they were dismissing it and everything like, I think they all must have seen it. And I suspect a lot of the crew probably thought the jokes were quite funny.
Yeah. Well, that's cruise for you.
It's the 60s, man.
Yeah. What were they smoking, eh? So, Martin, have you got any parting words to share?
Not really. I you did ask me why I picked it. I suppose it's possibly because it was the Sellers film I was possibly most familiar with, and then I realised how unfamiliar I was with it. But I think it's an experience. It's a really hard film to love, but it is, as I said right at the top, it feels like the 60s in bottled form. It feels
yes.
like concentrated 1960s. And if your idea of the 1960s comes from things like the Austin Powers films, you can see where they got it from. You want to know what the 60s sort of, in its most excessive form, looked like. Casino Royale's probably a good place to start looking.
I would agree. A good double bill would be Casino Royale and what's that film? Modesty Blaze, which I think was the year before.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the 60s was so full of spies and spy spoofs and everything like that. Like I say, it's riding on a wave of that. And these things were incredibly popular. And again, it's all the fault of that there Scotsman.
Mm. mm. You know. No. Well, Martin, it's been real.
It's been a James Bond film.
Thank you so much, mate, and we will talk again.
Always a pleasure. You take care. That formula is sealed with a 007. He's got a redhead in his arm. Well, he's a lover. When you are in trouble, have no fear. And knife. We're fighting for our life. Have no fear, Bond is here. He's gonna save the world at Casino Royale.